This is Fun Fact, and I'm here to say.
Oh, okay. I've got a good fact, and it's A-OK.
Fun fact. LEDs are a form of solar panel, and solar panels are a form of LED.
Okay. Is this like a tautology situation?
Is it a tautology? Yes, but I don't know. So we're all familiar, or most people are familiar with LEDs. They're the little things they make light.
Yeah, they stand for light emitting diode.
Light emitting diode. And most people are familiar with solar panels.
Which stands for solar.
Electricity. It stands for solar. Yeah, solar stands for solar. And people tend to think of those as two different things.
I do think of those as two different things.
Yeah, and as did I until I came across this cool video by Steve Mould, which I will link in the show notes.
I like that you pointed towards the show notes.
I pointed to the show notes on the non-video component of this podcast.
We don't even have show notes. Anyway, yeah.
That pointed out and explained why that LEDs and solar panels are the same thing.
Okay, that you've said that now some number of times that I'm not going to embarrass you by counting. What does that mean?
So it means that if you shine light on an LED, it will produce a voltage. And if you put current through a solar panel, it will give off light.
Wait, so they're like the reverse of each other?
They're the same thing, but they are optimized for being used in reverse ways. So the underlying mechanism here is that they're both diodes. Like, obviously, an LED is a diode. That's the D in LED. I didn't know until I learned this that solar panels are also diodes.
What is a diode? But
what is a diode? A diode is a little electronic valve. So it's a piece of semiconductor that has been set up so that current only flows in one direction through it. So current doesn't go the other way. So that's useful for making circuits and doing various things. But when current flows through a diode, because of the way that it works, it also emits some photons. And so a garden variety silicon diode, if you're just like building a circuit, releases a tiny amount of light, but it only releases infrared light.
Okay, which we can't see, but other animals can.
Yeah, but humans can't see the infrared light. And so we don't think of like a traditional diode as a light emitting diode because we can't even see the light.
A trad D, I call them.
That's what we typically call them, the trad Ds. And they also might be painted or covered with something that keeps the light in or whatever. So that's not like an interesting application typically of our traditional. It's just this kind of interesting side effect about how it works. But what we call LEDs are just other formulations of diodes. So rather than using silicon, they use other substances, which make it so that the light that comes off of them are in higher and higher energy levels, which makes them able to be seen depending on whether you want red or green or blue or different wavelengths.
Yeah, I don't know that you're going to get into this, but I don't have the information about this, but I did see a link to a video recommended to me a bunch of times that at some point I will click on and watch about why red and green were extremely easy LEDs to invent,
yes.
And blue was perhaps almost impossible.
Yes. Yeah, it's a good video. We can link that one too. But the blue, because blue is the highest energy level. So getting from what a diode will do by default, if you build a silicon diode, which is this like infrared, which is like so low energy, we can't even see it, up to the highest range of visible light was this amazing engineering challenge. And there's a cool story about the engineer who just stuck with it and kept trying to figure out how to make it work so we could all have obnoxious blue LED indicator lights in all of our appliances and things for 20 years.
So an LED that we use for lights is a diode. The current flows in and it produces light. But you also said that if you put light onto an LED, it generates current. Is that what you said?
Yes. So if light hits a diode, then that induces a voltage in the opposite direction.
But I thought the diode was designed not to allow that.
Well, if you paint the diode or cover it or whatever, obviously light can't hit it. But just in terms of the way a diode works by default, if light hits it, then that light will induce a voltage in the opposite direction.
What I'm trying to understand here is that your original explanation of what a diode is was that it was a transistor that only let current flow in one direction.
Yes.
So if light's hitting it and generating current in the opposite direction, how are those two things compatible facts?
So it's when you apply current to it in one direction, then nothing will happen. If you apply current to it in the opposite direction, it will flow through and produce light.
I see.
Now, if you want to make sure that current never goes in the opposite direction, then you have to cover the diode so light can't hit it.
Right, because when light gets generated, it generates current in the direction that does nothing.
Yes.
Except that then you can capture it and power everything.
Yes. So if you've decided that you actually want this aspect of diodes where light shining on them induces current in a certain direction, then you could make a whole panel of them repeating in a certain way over and over and over again and put it under the sun. And then suddenly that thing that you didn't want diodes to do is actually fairly useful. And you have created a solar panel.
So is this how... So there are LED lights which are self-powered.
Yes.
Like, is that how they work?
You can have a solar. No, because if you...
It doesn't generate enough.
If you put... if you shine light on an LED, like if you put a voltmeter on the ends of an LED and then you shine a light on it, even just a flashlight, you'll be able to measure that there's actually a voltage. Like it's working, garden variety LED that we would have. It works as a solar quote-unquote panel, but it's a very inefficient one.
Okay, yeah. So it's just not enough to power the LED.
Yeah, it's not enough to power itself. But like in theory, if it was hooked up to a battery, you could make a circuit where like this, it charged up and charged up and charged up a battery and then eventually powered itself for a while.
Yeah. But not fast enough to maintain itself.
Not for very long. Yeah. It wouldn't be very efficient. And so LEDs and solar panels are different optimizations of diode. One that optimizes for its light producing capabilities and the other for its light receiving capabilities. But they're variants of the same thing.
What would happen if you sent the current from a solar panel back into the diode? Would you have a LED roof on your house?
Yes. So if you apply current to the solar panel, just like a normal garden variety solar panel, then it will produce infrared light.
But it's infrared. Most kinds of okay.
Yeah, but yeah, there are okay. Some kinds of solar panels that will produce visible light if you put current on them, but they're unusual. The typical one creates infrared light, but that is actually apparently still useful for diagnosing, like if there might be, like if you're seeing lower
like a dead spot
output.
Or something like that.
Exactly. Yeah.
So but here's what I'm thinking. I don't know if this will make the show or not, but Alan suggested earlier that he wants to build a gaming PC and yes. That he might go full gamer and have like a cool
RGB
LED
lights.
RGB PC. And now I'm thinking that Alan should go farther than that and have an RGB house.
Yes. I think my neighbors would love that.
I think all of your neighbors would love that.
And then they would be like, why do you have all those obnoxious LEDs? And then I could be like, they're actually solar panels.
Yeah, I'm actually helping the environment.
Yeah.
Do you even environment, bro?
I think that would work.
Yeah, I think it's a foolproof plan.
So fundamentally, the moral of this story is that diodes are simply
a
thing
awesome.
that they are awesome, and they're simply a thing that converts in between light and electricity, and they can go in both directions. And depending on which direction that the diode is optimized for, you might call it a solar panel and or an LED. Bonus fun fact.
Yeah, this is very cool.
Motors and generators are also the same thing.
Okay, sure.
In the same way. Motors are not very
generators
good at generator,
reverse.
And generators are not very good at being motors because they've been optimized for different things. But in general, like the same like fundamental principles that make, for example, an electric motor or an electric generator are so much the same that you can, in many cases, actually just use something that was designed to be one as the other if you just do the thing in reverse.
That's very fun and cool. And it makes me think, though, so in the case of the solar panels and the LEDs, which you researched more intently, mm-hmm. Did your research reveal to you which came first?
The LED or the solar panel?
Yeah.
I did not come across that. I would assume that LEDs, well, yeah, I don't know.
See, I don't know either. And I'm super curious. I would love to know, and maybe we could do a follow-up fact sometime about the history of, like, did one of them get developed, and then the other one was like, oh, I wonder what happens if, like, did they have any relationship to each other that way? Because I do think, Like, it would make sense, right? If, like, one of them was invented and they were like, wait a minute, what if we...
Yeah.
Then you get the other one.
Yeah, I imagine that was the case. I just don't know off the top of my head.
Yeah.
Motors and generators have been around for longer, so it's probably harder to tell, but they have the same effect. And you also have the same effect for pumps and turbines.
Okay, yeah, basically anything where it's how would you define this? It's like a taxonomical thing. It's like where the effect is theoretically bidirectional. You could always build something that does the effect in either direction.
Right. And then I got one for you is microphones and speakers.
Oh yeah.
They're just diaphragms that convert sound
into
electricity. So if you take a microphone and a speaker, for most microphones and speakers, like this won't work for all of them because it can be so, you can get such diminishing returns, but you can take a speaker diaphragm and talk right directly into it. And then it can actually power another speaker on the other end. And you can actually get transmission of sound, and you can do the same thing for microphones. You can have a microphone create sound because it has a little diaphragm, so you apply power to it. You'll probably destroy the microphone, right? But you'll apply power to the microphone and it can actually make sound because it's a
so actually really the simpler distillation of the principle you're describing is that any converter can convert in both directions. And so if you build something that turns X into Y, you can potentially, well, not any, actually that's not true. Some are destructive and one directional, right? But many things that can convert X into Y will use a similar principle if converting Y into X.
Yeah. And I think the things that all of these have in common, electrical motors, pumps, turbines, speakers, microphones, LEDs, solar panels, is that they're converting in between some force and electricity, right? So one is like sound waves, one is motion, and one is a liquid moving, and one is light, right? So all of those things are different forms of energy and is converting them into electricity. And so it seems like, and now I'm getting out of what I prepared, but like it seems like there's like kind of an underlying principle is that if you tend to create something that can convert in between electricity and some force, then it probably would work in the opposite direction. But there might be other examples of that too.
Yeah, I mean, the same thing in a sense happens with digital audio sound components, right? Like you can go in both directions there too. You can convert, I mean, that's what like an oscillator is, right? It converts electricity into sound, and then you convert sound into, you know, electricity when you want to record sound.
So next time you need an LED,
just go on my roof and get one of the solar panels. But it's all infrared, it's not that useful.
Yeah, but you know, if you want to like control your TV, maybe, I don't know.
I could program my solar panels to be the world's most useless universal remote. Yeah, that sounds like a great idea. You know what, my friend? It's your lucky day.
Oh, I'm excited.
Because I also have a fact that has something to do with electricity.
Ooh, electricity-related facts.
Yeah. We are aligned, my man. We are hitting on all cylinders in
all
motor
voltages.
That is also a generator, which wouldn't then have still. Anyway, so fun fact. The earliest taxi cabs were electric, not gas.
Ah, I've heard a couple of little clips about the early electrification of automobiles.
Yeah, it could have gone in a very different direction.
It could have gone different. Tell me about these amazing early taxi cabs.
I will tell you about them. I'm going to tell you about quite a few things relating to taxi cabs because my original motivation for looking up this fact, I stumbled upon this electric thing. I was trying to determine, as I am wont to do, what the etymological differences were between taxi and cab.
Sure. Uh-huh.
And I landed, and as I dove into this subject, what I discovered is that essentially every part of this story and situation is, to my mind, quite interesting and way more interesting than I expected when I started.
Okay.
So I just kept finding more things about sort of the history of cabs that was like, huh, I didn't know that. Now, when I am talking about all of these various modes of transportation that I'm about to talk about, I thought it was helpful to look at the Wikipedia definition because I also enjoy definitions, as do you, taxonomical categorization. And so Wikipedia refers to all of this as a type of vehicle for hire with a driver used by a single passenger or a small group of passengers, often for a non-shared ride.
Okay.
So we're talking very specifically about things that a modern observer would look at and say, yeah, that's a taxi.
Yeah, that makes sense.
As distinguished from public transportation, primarily based on whether or not you get to decide where you get picked up and dropped off, or whether some sort of predetermined pickup and drop off has been arranged.
Right? Yeah, that makes sense.
So the first taxis, at least from a European American perspective, I didn't look into like worldwide, but from for Europe and America and Canada, the first quote unquote taxis were what were horse-drawn carriages, right?
Of course.
And they started in Paris and London like in the early 17th century, and they were called, at least in English, hackney carriages. Is that a term you know?
No. I mean, I know the term hackney, but I don't know hackney carriages.
Yeah, so hackney is still the a common word used for these in the UK. And hack, if you've ever heard that, like, he drives a hack, or he is a hack and drives a hack.
He's a total hack.
Is in, not hack like in the sense of, like, he sucks. Like, a hack in the sense that he's, or a hacker, a hack in the sense that he drives a cab.
Oh, I haven't heard that version.
Is a term used in New York still today.
Oh, okay.
Like, you will hear that. Like, I drive a hack, or I am a hack and I drive a hack, and that kind of thing.
Okay.
So no one knows the etymology of that one. Probably has something to do with the London borough of Hackney. Also might be French. Who knows? Who cares? But like the first taxi cabs were these hackney carriages, and they were four wheeled carriages with two horses that sat six people.
Yeah. Okay. And I'm imagining six people sitting one way, three people sitting each way facing each other.
No. So two people sit each way facing each other.
Okay.
And two people sit on the front outside, and that's the driver and the driver's servant.
Right. The driver has a servant.
The driver has a servant. Now, the driver, hilariously in my mind, was popularly referred to as a jarvey.
Okay.
And that is a literal reference to the first Sherlock Holmes story.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
A Study in Scarlet. Because in A Study in Scarlet, which I actually reread recently for the first time in many, many years, I'm a big Sherlock Holmes fan. There is a driver of a small cab who's named Jarvis. And I guess Jarvey is a nickname for Jarvis, which I didn't know because I don't know anyone named Jarvis except for like fictional British butlers and a fictional British butler turned into Iron Man's computer assistant.
Uh-huh. Those are the
but
two
as
main
a
ones.
Sherlock Holmes fan, I was extremely delighted to discover that there was a Holmes connection to all of this. And A Study in Scarlet, not his best, but it was also his first, so it's not.
Makes sense.
That's surprising. Anyway,
but it was well known enough that people would refer to cab drivers.
Hugely popular. Term. Yeah. And then they would, Jarveys were driving hackneys, which is just delightful to me. And then by the 1800s, they got mostly replaced by hansom cabs.
So this is, you're telling me the replacement is the vehicle, style of vehicle has now changed.
The style of vehicle has now changed. It's called a hansom cab. Which I've also heard Sherlock Holmes say in various Sherlock Holmes series. And I thought that they were saying handsome cabs. And I was like, what's handsome about these cabs?
Yeah, that's just how I had been interpreting what you were saying.
But it's not handsome. It's handsome.
Oh, there's no D.
There's no D. Now, a hansom cab was a smaller, faster, safer, one horse variant cab.
Okay.
They had like some structural stuff underneath to make it much, much safer. There was like some axle changes.
Oh, okay.
And then thus would allow it to be powered by one horse.
Okay.
This is where we get the term cab from.
Okay.
The hansom cab. They were mostly referred to at the time as hansoms. Hansom comes from the name of the inventor, as so many things do. Correct. Joseph Hansom.
Sure.
And cab, which we still use today, is shortened version of what word? Do you know?
Cabriolet.
Cabriolet, which we use today, at least in America, at least in the United States of America, to mean convertible.
Yeah.
Is that also what it means in Canada?
It's not a term that I just think of it as a French word for a vehicle more than I think of it as a thing that people market new vehicles as. But I know
you can buy cabriolets. It's a style of car you can buy here, not in Canada.
I would imagine they use the same branding in Canada is that most of the model style names are the same. So if there's a, like, what's an example of a vehicle that is sold as a Cabriolet?
That's a great question. I don't know. The 2024 Audi A5 Cabriolet Luxury Convertible is the first one that comes up.
Yeah, that's what they call it. They call it the same thing in Canada.
Yeah. So
I just don't shop luxury convertibles frequently.
Hey, I'm not buying a lot of Cabriolets either. Don't even really get in a lot of cabs anymore. But so the word Cabriolet, you're correct. It's obviously a French word. It comes from the French cabrioler, probably cabriolet, and I'm just mispronouncing it. But anyway, it means to leap or to caper.
Okay.
And that originally comes from the Latin word for a wild goat.
Which, you know, goats leap.
The word at the time was applied to these hansom cabs, not because they were convertible, because they weren't, but because they were like nimble and like they were a style of carriage called a fly. And the fly in this sense refers to their ability to quickly move fast, like a Lord of the Rings style. Yeah, fly, sure. You fool, yes. That sort of fly.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And so they, the like a wild goat, like a baby wild goat, they would like caper about and leap through the streets on the cobblestones of like, you know, industrial era London and whatever. Although actually the hansom cab company started in New York, and I just found it really like, I don't know, charming that they, you could pay, there were two different schemes for paying.
Okay.
You could either pay by distance or by time.
Okay.
And if it was by distance, they charged either, depending on if you had one person or two people, it was like a different rate. For one person, it was 30 cents per mile. Okay. And for two people, it was 40 cents per mile, which is actually like a pretty good, it's a pretty good like deal though, right? Like you're not doubling for the two, but you could also pay by time. You could get an hour for 75 cents or for one person or an hour for two people for a dollar.
Okay.
So you could just rent a cab for the whole, like for an 8-hour shift for $8.
Not bad.
I mean, not bad. I assume you
can do that for like with a hired car. I don't know. I haven't hired a black car in a long time, but I assume you can.
I mean, either
hire a black car for by time too.
Probably, but I don't know if you can do like a yellow cab by time. I mean, there is a time component, right? You can.
I'm sure you can find a way.
In your country of Canada, in case anyone doesn't remember that, in your beloved Canada, the first taxi company in Toronto was called The City. And I don't know if this still exists. I doubt it.
The City.
The City was the name of the cab.
Not like the first cab company in Toronto. Company or something.
No, just The City. And it was created by an illiterate runaway slave from Kentucky.
Okay.
Named Thornton Blackburn, whose capture and ultimate rescue in Detroit triggered both what are called the Blackburn Riots and the legal precedent that slaves who made it to Canada would not be extradited to the U.S., which created the end of the Underground Railroad.
Oh, interesting.
Wait, yeah.
So there was legal precedent that slaves that made it to Canada would not be extradited back.
Which meant it didn't end. It created the end of the path.
Oh, it created the path. Right. So the Underground Railroad then.
The Underground Railroad was trying to figure out where to go. Right. And the problem is, if you ended up in the North, you were better than in the South in this country, but you could still be returned to your master if you were caught.
Right.
But if you made it to Canada, you were completely free because Canada had outlawed slavery at a also shameful but much less shameful time period than we did. And so but the guy whose legal battle created that case also happened to create a taxi cab company.
Canadian cab company.
Yes. Right. His life is incredible, and I would recommend reading more about it. I didn't want to dawdle too long on this point. But at any rate, these hansoms and hackneys, they lasted until like the late 19th century, like really like the 1890s, 1880s. And then they were replaced by the thing I mentioned in my original fact, which was modern electric taxi cabs.
Okay. So
all of the earliest taxis were electric vehicles, and it was another few decades before gas versions fully took over from them.
Why? So what was it about taxi services? Because as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, but in those early automobile eras, 1890s, 1900s, 1910s, there was a mix of electric and gas vehicles on the road.
Yeah.
So it seems like you're saying that there was something about taxis that made it so that they opted for electric in particular in those early days.
I think that it wasn't so much that there was like a benefit, strong benefit to taxis that made them good to be electric. I think it's that the people who, or the person in particular who first introduced like horseless carriages to taxis in London, happened to build a fleet of electric cabs. They were launched in August of 1897, and they were nicknamed hummingbirds because they made like an electric humming sound.
Mm-hmm.
And then that same year in New York, a company called the Samuels Electric Carriage and Wagon Company also began running 12 electric hansom cabs. And that lasted until like 1898 when they became the Electric Vehicle Company. But the point is, like, all of these were pretty much electric. I don't think it was because of a specific advantage to I didn't see any like specific advantage. I think it's just sort of a almost a happenstance circumstance. What is interesting is that those cabs, those electric cabs, didn't actually have a meter.
Okay.
Like, because the original taxi meter, which of course is where the name taxi comes from, was called the taxonome.
Okay.
And it was invented in Germany by a guy named Wilhelm Nadler, who was a music teacher.
Okay.
Who was really annoyed at his students butchering the rhythm while listening to a metronome.
Okay.
Which is why it's called a taxonome, because it rhymes with metronome.
Okay.
And it's also a portmanteau of a word that was common in German at that time, but has mostly fallen out of favor, called taxa, which meant like charge and was used at the time for like your cab fare.
Okay. But and this is all etymologically related to the fact that we pay tax.
Yes, exactly. And even today, they're still called Taxikosten in Germany. Okay. They have many terms for it now, but they still will use that. But so basically, like, this guy invented this taximeter. And then at the same time, the Daimler of like Mercedes, invented the world's first gasoline-powered taximeter cab. And that started in Germany in 1897. So all of the taxi cabs in London and in New York, which had started a little bit earlier, were all electric. And then in Germany, they started with gas taxis. And then that moved eventually to Paris and then London and then New York. And like over time, over decades, like essentially took over and pushed out the electric cabs, because electric cabs actually had disadvantages that they were like, there wasn't a lot of charging infrastructure. The batteries at the time weren't super great. They were using like really basic, like the kind of batteries you would use like to jumpstart your car now, right? Like we're the kind
of, like 100 years worse technology of the same lead acid that we use today, but like not even refined as well as it is now. And this article here is saying that they were, at least some of these early electric cabs, they were like operated fine when you first bought them, but they were so heavy that like all the parts like wore really poorly, and like the wheels would get worn out, and like they would be vibrating, and that would hurt the battery. And like there was like the cab owners were mad at the companies that were selling them, and there's a bunch of problems.
Exactly. So by the way, just as an aside, the way that these taxi meters worked was like really fascinating, because it was like a what's called a K constant pulse. They would have to tune for like exactly how much they wanted to charge. Like that would determine like how, when you had driven every kilometer, to like determine your distance for charging. And then they would have to like tune that to include like the surcharge they wanted to put. It's all crazy. At any rate, the bonus fun fact, which is a hilarious thing to say after many, many facts that I have presented you with, is that the taxis played a huge role in Paris in a French victory in World War I.
Oh.
So on September 7th, 1914, the military governor of Paris gathered 600 taxis to ferry soldiers to a city where a battle was happening, like 50 kilometers away.
Okay.
And in 24 hours, the taxis managed to ferry 6,000 soldiers to the front. Wow. Each taxi had 5 soldiers in it. And they only used the back lights of the cabs. Like, they wouldn't use their headlights because they wouldn't be seen. So you would just follow the headlights in front of you. I don't know what the first person did. But at any rate, they completely surprised the German army, who were forced back. And the only reason I tell you this story is because, due to a Paris city regulation, the taxi drivers were required to run their meters during the entire thing.
Okay.
And then the French treasury had to reimburse them for the fares.
Sure.
And the final fare was 70,012 francs at the time, which I managed to convert through a couple of fun pathways to what I think is a rough equivalent of what that is today. And it's $383,000 in modern money, which I still feel like is a pretty good deal.
It's a pretty good deal for winning a battle. If you can exactly. Tell the military, hey, for $300,000, we can just like silently drop in a bunch of soldiers into
we'll just
to win
solve
this battle.
Problem.
Like,
all
I feel
done.
Like that's a good deal.
Yeah. So, yeah, we could have had electric cars, but they didn't want us to, Alan. It's not that the technology was bad. They just didn't want us to.
Yeah, it was the oil companies.
That's right.
I mean, I'm sure it was also a little bit the oil companies, but there was also some challenges.
There were.
I love it. I'm just imagining this like convoy now.
Yeah, for real. I left out so many fun details, like how New York taxi cabs ended up yellow. Like, seriously, as I was reading the taxi article, like, just I mean, you'll see in the show notes, folks, there are a lot of links from me this time around. The history of all of this just is so interesting and so much more interesting than I would have ever imagined.
All right. Well, I have a non-electric related fact.
What are we even doing?
I know. I didn't prepare properly. I didn't know what the theme was.
Yeah.
Fun fact. Hamster eggs have the rare property that they can be fertilized by other species' zygotes. This means it's possible to create a human hamster hybrid, which they call Humster.
Oh, who's the they? Let's start there. I was gonna start by trying to figure out how this relates to electricity, but instead let's start with who's the they who calls it a humster?
I would think it would be Humster.
You're implying, I think, by your choice of words, that the human hamster hybrids are the ones who are calling it Humster.
No, so the human hamster hybrids don't get to the point of having self-naming or other autonomous behaviors because they only exist as a single cell. That's about as far as they get.
Okay, so it's not really true to say that hamsters can reproduce with people.
I didn't say that.
I feel like you did. I feel like that was what you
said. I feel like hamsters reproducing with people, we wouldn't have heard about this by now. I feel like that would be a fact that you wouldn't come across it first from a podcast. But what can happen is a human hamster hybrid cell can be created with a human sperm and a hamster egg.
Okay, hold on a second. First of all, I would say that I think you're undervaluing the importance of this podcast. But also, I would say, okay.
I'm just saying we share facts that are not commonly known yet.
So, yes. So that's okay, fair enough. So first of all, this only goes in one direction is what I'm taking from this, because human eggs cannot be fertilized by hamster sperm.
Correct. Also, a hamster sperm cannot fertilize a human egg, just in case you're wondering.
Yeah.
Don't bother.
It's one directional. This is not a whatever we're going to call those things from the first fact, where they go in both directions. But like, so yes. There probably
it's not
is
like electricity.
But so
reciprocal.
Reciprocal. That's a great word. So a hamster egg can be fertilized by human sperm to produce one cell.
Yes, of a human hamster hybrid.
Why?
Which they call a humster.
Who cares?
researchers who are studying infertility care.
Okay, this is where this gets interesting. Okay. Not that it wasn't interesting before.
So apparently there's a test called the hamster zona-free ovum test that is used in fertility research.
Okay. Rolls right
where
off the tongue.
But if they're evaluating the potency of human sperm, that one of the things that they can do is they can test whether or not it can.
If you can't fertilize a hamster egg,
because everyone can fertilize a hamster egg. To be clear, this is not a specific thing about humans. Like other.
No, anything can fertilize a hamster egg.
I'm sure there's a limit. Like, I don't know if like a fruit fly could, but like
someone spent some time trying.
Science definitely knows the answer to that question. I just don't know the answer, but like, it's not a human specific thing.
One of my favorite random things about math is that, and when I say math, I don't mean the concept of math. I mean like the study of math.
Yeah.
Is that all math starts out as what is called pure math.
Yes.
And it only moves into what we call applied math, which are completely different fields of study, when someone finds a use for it.
Right.
Originally, it's just math. Mm-hmm. Then it's something more than math. It's something with a use. And I'm not even saying that there's more value to one than the other, but that is what happens. And the thing about that is that the only way that pure math moves to applied math in modern times is that somebody with an applied math mindset looks at a pure math paper and goes, huh, I bet I could use that for this. Because right. The pure math people, we've specialized so much over the last, I don't know, few hundred years, that pure mathematicians don't care about applied mathematics, and applied mathematicians are not pure mathematicians. And what that means in, and this was true 20 years ago, so undoubtedly even more true today, is that more pure math papers are being written every year than anyone has time to read.
Right. Because they're just mathing for the sake of math.
They're just mathing. And therefore, we have absolutely no idea how many useful applied mathematics concepts are sitting on a pure math shelf that no one, or at least not the right person, has looked at to determine. And I feel like we're in a very similar zone here where somebody discovered for some reason that human sperm...
Why are they researching this?
That other animal species sperm could fertilize hamster eggs, right? Yeah. I'm not going to suggest how they got there. I don't know how they got there. And then someone thought, oh, we could use that as a fertility test. And it went from being sciencing for the purposes of sciencing to, oh, that's actually extremely useful.
Yeah. And so apparently the test isn't done like super commonly because it's like fairly expensive to do. But apparently it exists and can be used for that purpose.
Yeah.
And now, you know, if you ever want to create
a humster,
morally dubious human other mammal hybrid.
I don't want to do that.
I'm just saying if you did, though.
Yeah, you've talked enough about this that I think you do, but I will say that
when it's only one cell, it's not as exciting. So I was thinking like if it was,
if there was a hamster,
like if it could be like your sidekick, it was like a half hamster.
It was like a half height hamster vibes. Yeah, that would be an abomination against all things. But
I'm pretty sure that would violate multiple international laws, even if it was possible.
You can't even clone a sheep like legally in a lot of places.
Yeah, I know. I feel like a half human, half hamster grown to maturity would be more problematic than the sheep.
But it's kind of like the opposite of the replication crisis, right? Like this thing where like there's just all this science being sciencing and no one knows if it's useful, and we might totally discover that like the solution to whatever has been around for, it's a little bit actually like with the COVID vaccines where they're like, oh yeah, we've known about mRNA for just a really long time and no one had done anything with it until they did, and then it was like, oh, this is actually really useful.
Yeah, there's a bunch of examples of that. I have this like kind of pet thing. It's not my personal pet thing, but like what some concept I find interesting.
Alan's
is
personal
that
pet thing.
My personal pet thing. No, just one of the things I find myself pondering sometimes is at what point will our advances in AI, for however you want to determine or define AI, will make it so that a bunch of that kind of research that we have done that is just kind of sat there then can be like analyzed and maybe brought to our attention again by looking at it from angles that no one would bother spending the time, you know, because you can brute force, you know, computers can brute force looking at 10 million combinations of something that no human would ever think to look at. And then one of those 10 million combinations might be like, this is kind of interesting. Maybe a human should look at this a second time. So I find that.
So I was fully prepared to mock you. And be like, you know what, this is just you.
Because Alan's talking about AI again.
Yeah, Alan's talking about AI. But that's actually really smart. Yeah, that's a really good use for AI.
Yeah, in general, I like the whole category of things where it's like, instead of the parts where it's like, oh, they make art for us, so we don't have to make art anymore. Like, that's the sad parts. But the parts where it's like, they just do ridiculously complicated, tedious work of surfacing stuff. And then they, like, can flag to humans that, like, 0.001% stuff that's really interesting that could drive some sort of breakthrough or make our lives better. Like that stuff I find really cool.
Yeah, that stuff we find really cool.
Trademark 2024.
Yeah.